All right, welcome back, everyone. It's been a while. Me and Nick have been busy working on various other projects and just living our lives, you know. Sorry if we've kept you waiting, but I'm sure you'll be very excited with what we have in the future, starting with today. A lot of things are going on, and me and Nick have a lot to talk about. We're going to start off talking about a little bit of politics. Some of you may or may not like that, but me and Nick give a pretty interesting opinion on it. So we'll start it off with the border wall.
All right.
Why don't you tell us about it, Nick?
So the border wall, so if you don't keep up with the news, which I think you should, Trump declares a national emergency for border security. And I don't know if you agree or disagree with that. It doesn't matter. Do you want to give your opinion, Mason? Do you agree with border security? In general, the border wall in general, not necessarily the national, like declaring a national emergency.
Well, my opinion on the border wall is, as always, a mixture of both sides. I mean, the argument that it's inherently inhumane or racist to build a wall, I think that's not a bad argument because, I mean, that just, it can't be used. But you can get in there and argue about whether or not the wall would be effective. And I think the argument that it won't be, because drug smugglers and people like that will find a way to get through, especially because a lot of them push drugs through the ocean, makes sense. But what people don't realize, and it might be hard for them to understand, is a big part of border security, I mean, the vast majority of it, it's not just drugs, it's literally people. It's stopping illegal immigration. And then, I mean, obviously there's a massive conversation, mostly propagated by the left, of whether or not that's a moral thing to do, is to fight illegal immigration. But that's the purpose, is I think that even if there's still some, you know, highly motivated, skilled coyotes and drug traffickers that are going to get around the wall, I think it'll still be effective for, like, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of your average everyday illegal immigrant. Which, and then you can go into the conversation of, I'm cool to have the conversation of, should we be allowing them in? I'm personally a proponent for an increase in legal immigration. Well, that's a conversation to have, but I definitely have a hard time wrapping my head around the idea that all immigration should be allowed.
Yeah, I get that.
But maybe I'm just indoctrinated by the ideas of a closed-bordered system. Who am I?
Well, like, for me personally, I think the argument that the president uses is, like, the drugs, stopping drug trafficking. So I'm for the wall if you consider, like, the, like, sex traffickers, because they're not going to go through legal ports of entries, most likely. They're going to smuggle them through the, or illegally. So that, in that case, I'm for the wall. But if it comes to, like, if we're talking drugs, like 90% of drug seizures happens at, like, a legal port of entry. So you can't really say that you're trying to stop drugs, because most of the time the drugs aren't moving through the border illegally.
Right. I guess one of the things that upsets me about the defense that the left is using is they're saying that, one, it's a waste of money, and even if we only get a minute amount of saved revenue from whatever drain that illegal immigration has in our economy, like, it would be paid back for in, like, 10 minutes. So that's the first thing, is, like, I don't know the actual statistics, but some people would argue that it's in the high tens of billions of dollars a year is, quote unquote, lost from the economy based on illegal immigration. I mean, a lot of it goes back to Mexico, which, once again, like, I'm not saying that that's a horrible thing. If you're going to send money back home to your family, be a legal immigrant, and then it can be tracked and whatnot. But that's the argument that it
well, so, like, like the financial aspect, like the money. I understand the whole, like, immigrants use money and all that. Like, there's a report, I think it was in December, that like 63% of non-citizen households access welfare programs compared to the 35% of native households. So if that's the argument that they want to use, but that's more of like a generalized immigration completely. I think just the view of when people come to America now is different than it was 20, 30 years ago. When you were to come here, it was more to pursue a better life and work hard. Now we've kind of become more of a welfare state.
Right. It's interesting. Well, the most interesting part of it is that it's a conversation that needs to be had, and it shouldn't be two dummies talking on a podcast. It should be congressmen having this conversation, but it won't never happen because it's too polarized. It actually might happen. I think it will. If there's one thing that you can give Trump, and I'm telling you, for many people, this is a horrible thing, but one that I still gets me excited. I don't know if it's because I like conflict and I like exposing people or whatnot. I think it's interesting. I think it's funny to call people out. But my point is, this is unprecedented. The things that Trump has done, whether it's shut down the government, which, you know, you may or may not agree with, and declaring a national emergency, like, if anything, at least it changes the normal ebb and flow of politics, which a lot of people would consider that an ignorant point of view because, well, it's changing it for the worse, but I don't know. I just, every time I see a mainstream politician freak out, it usually puts a smile on my face.
Well, yeah, a lot of them are career politicians. Which I think in general, we shouldn't have career politicians. It shouldn't be a career. I think that's just ridiculous.
No, we've probably talked about this before, but the purpose of a politician is supposed to be the most successful people from within a society, whether it's business, whether it's law, whether it's entrepreneurship or military service, whatever it is. The best people live and pursue a very successful career. And then after that, they give back to the country that enabled their success by using the skills that they learned throughout their career to give back and now lead the country to provide and to create more of the opportunity that they took advantage of throughout their career, and they're using their experience that they gained along the way to fucking make good decisions. And I mean, now that's obviously not what happened nowadays. Like, nowadays there are career politicians. There's politicians that aren't trying to create more opportunity for other people. It's a left versus right, you know, mindset. And the idea that when you look at some of these politicians, and once again, like, it's not all of them, but there's a good handful of politicians that legitimately don't know what success is. How can you be dictating a way that the government creates opportunity, protects rights, protects liberties, when you don't even know what that means yet? You don't even, like, you have no idea what it means, especially when it's on a national level and you haven't experienced anything outside of your current state. Like, I was listening to someone talk once, and they were saying that the difference between someone living in Montana and someone living in New York City is two different countries. And so many people don't even understand that concept, that if you're going to govern on a national perspective, you have to keep everyone's perspective in mind. But what were you going to say, Nick?
Well, I was going to say how, like you said, they've never actually experienced like what a lot of the issues are, like, domestically. They don't understand any of it. Most of them get a four-year degree, usually political science, which that doesn't really break down each issue and how it relates to the people living in a certain area, just a generic degree. And then they get a law school for, I think, 3 years, because that's a constitutional law degree, is 3 years, I'm pretty sure. So they go to school for 7 years. Now they're 25, old enough to run for Congress, but they probably go local and then they just move up and that's their career. they just move up.
One thing I will say is that I'm a huge believer in learning stuff through reading and whatnot. I think that the closest thing to a life experience is like reading it and studying it. And I think that there's in a life today where you want to have a knowledge that expands farther than just what you've specifically learned on your own through your own experiences. I think it's good to do things like this, to have an array of knowledge, and you should be allowed to speak on it. You know, you shouldn't have to have experienced, you know, World War II to give an educated opinion on it, obviously. But at the same time, there is something you get from a real life experience that, you know, can't be translated into writing. And I think that that's a big issue with this style of, you know, political entry, is when you have no life experience, when you have zero personal experience of what it's like. You know, you can read and you can understand, you can get a decent, just like opinion of what it's like to live in some of these places and what they want and how to govern them. But for the most part, I think you are lacking something, especially when you haven't been there. You know what I mean? So it kind of blows my mind. And then the worst is when people degrade other people from those more unique areas of the country and call them unintelligent or whatnot. And that's not the case at all, especially with the influx of the internet. Like, there's people that are highly intelligent in all walks of life. And just because someone has a different opinion than you and holds a different value system doesn't mean that they're right or wrong. And I think that that's one of the issues that the left has propagated, is that if you're not, their opinion is the best, meaning whoever is the most open-minded and the most accepting is winning when it comes to, as if there should be a winner when it comes to differing opinions. There shouldn't be a winner. It should be that everyone's opinion is somewhat equal. But this is the caveat of the whole situation here, is that the left said, the whole point of the left is to say that all opinions are equal, but at the same time, it's like all opinions are equal except if your opinion isn't their opinion. I don't even know how to describe it.
Well, like, I want to just throw all of it on to the left. I would say the right does it as well, but
right.
But
no,
at the end of the day, it's the same split that we have. It's one side thinks this side is wrong, the other side thinks this side is wrong. Maybe I personally believe that both sides, they have the same end goal in theory. They just have different ways of getting there, and no one's evil or good for whichever opinion they have. They're just different.
But I guess what gets to me is I hate being lied to. I'm cool with a certain, I understand that the way the political system is engineered, there's going to be a certain level of corruption. There's going to be a certain level of just the way things are. But admit it, you know, and I think one thing the right does is the right holds their opinions, understands that they're not, you know, God's gift to equality and like open-mindedness, and they admit it, and they're like, this is what we believe. But I think that's what bugs me on the left, is even if they are doing the same thing the right's doing, they also hold this, you know, higher than mighty opinion about themselves, which is not the way it's supposed to work.
It's the same thing, the old saying, if you're not a liberal when you're 18, you have no heart. If you're not conservative by the age 30, you have no brain. It's the same,
right?
Same, I guess, stereotype of what each party thinks of the other. And I think that's how we get the decisiveness and the division between half the country, because half the country is liberal, half the country is conservative.
And I think that if you're listening to this, some people might think that we're not, like, we're hardcore conservative or something, but we're actually, we're not. And I really hate, what I won't do is I won't say that I'm a centrist, because I can't say that, well, we're just center and we don't like politics. No, I think that that's one of the worst things you can do is say, well, I just don't participate in politics and I have center views. Like, that's not the case. But I think that me and Nick's views can range from anything from hyper-conservative to hyper-liberal, just depending on whatever the topic is. And I definitely see there's a vast need for Democrats. There's a need for this. What I know, if you're a conservative, listen to this, you're going to hate it, but there's a need for liberals. There's a need for people because in a high functioning society like the one we have, it's based on, you know, hierarchies and people being massively successful. And the reality is, in some cases, there's going to be people that for whatever reason fail or for whatever reason can't survive in this, you know, winner takes all society. And who's there to protect them? It's going to be the liberals. It's going to be the Democrats. And they play a function. They play a role. And it's literally that's why we have a polarized society, is because each side plays a role. But the argument should be that we're here to balance each other out, not to, you know, try to overtake each other.
Yeah, and we got a little off topic, but do you want to tell them a little bit about the National Emergency Declaration, like more about the specific one?
Yeah. So the first thing to note is that there's about 28 to 31. I couldn't really get the exact number, but that's only three off. But 28 to 31 current national emergencies, meaning that there's been about 60 national emergencies ever declared, but a lot of them will be rescinded once the emergency is over. But right now there's 30 national emergencies currently at play. I will admit, though, when people say, like, the argument that there's 30 national emergencies to defend Trump's use of the national emergency clause is not a good excuse, because of those national emergencies, all of them are based on some sort of foreign policy, meaning probably about half of them relate to terrorism, and the other half relate to drugs, the gun trade, or some sort of African dictatorship. And it basically allows for, you know, sanctions and a certain level of, you know, military force to be used against whether it is a dictatorship or a terrorist organization or something of that nature, or like the drug trade. So to say that a national emergency is a valid use for building a wall, I don't know. But I do know that effectively, if it went through, it's effective in that instead of getting the $5 billion that he asked for, he's going to get about $8 billion. The first being the about the $1.5 billion that's going to come from just already being allocated by Congress in the agreement that happened in the past recently. And then there's going to be another $1 billion that comes from Congress. And then there's going to be about $5 billion that comes from military construction allocation funds.
It'll
be effective.
Well, like what you were saying about the national emergencies, like it doesn't, I can see how, like, I'm sure it will go to the Supreme Court because that's what a lot of big policies go to. But I can see how they can make the argument for a national emergency. It's for national protection, blah, blah, border security. But one of the worries I have with it is the precedent it's going to set, or it's going to set for, like, future presidents. For the people who are hardcore Trump fans, they're like, they love it. They're like, all right, we're going to get our wall. But what happens when he's no longer president and an extreme progressive takes over in office? The new Green Deal, or whatever it's called, Green New Deal, whatever. We get a super progressive president. National emergency. Next thing you know, that green New Deal is now in action. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's the same thing with the nuclear option that the Senate did, setting it to 50 votes to pass a bill instead of, I think, the 60. did a nuclear option when Obama was president to get Obamacare through. And next you know, Trump takes office. They did it for the Supreme Court. It's a game that no side's going to end up winning. It's just going to cause more damage.
So what's the nuclear option? Explain that.
The nuclear option was basically in the Senate, you did need 60 votes to pass like a bill. Then when you set the nuclear option, it sets it to just simple majority. So 51 is all you need.
How is that invoked, or what's the purpose of that?
The purpose of that is so you can get something passed. So the Obama administration and the Senate at the time.
Right, but who validates it? Like, who turns it on? Is it the president that turns it on?
So I'm pretty sure the Senate majority leader can request a vote on it, a vote on enacting the nuclear option, and I think that just needs a simple majority to enact it.
So here's my thing with this national emergency that I'm going to say that it's not as big of a deal as you're saying. So I think it would be a massive issue if it was, you know, we'll just raise taxes through the roof to pay for this sort of stuff. But the thing is with the national emergency is that it's not like increasing taxes to pay for this. What it's doing is just reallocating money. So depending on your view of the government and how efficient and effective you think it is, you may or may not be upset that there is money being reallocated from other things. But my argument is, I mean, and this is, we'll get into a personal belief here, is I think that the government is extremely inefficient and extremely superfluous with the amount of money that it throws around. So if we're going to take, and this isn't just for his national emergency, it could be for something in the future, but the argument that a president shouldn't be able to reallocate funds, like, I might be okay with that. I might be okay with, if Trump does it now, okay, because as the president, he is choosing that to say that this is where the money should be spent. And then you go into the future and you have, you know, an extremely liberal president who says this is where the money should be spent. You know, to me, as long as you stay out of my business and don't tax me more, I'm a pretty self-reliant person. I don't fear changes in the government. Like, as long as I get what's mine and I get to spend my free time working on my goals and my aspirations and achieving my own personal level of success, I don't care how the government spends the money that it already has. And I guess that's probably comes from me being an individual who 100% relies on my own efforts and sees my future being 100% reliant on the things that I've created and not reliant on the government in any manner. I could care less if the government failed and we got a new government, because I'm going to still do what I'm doing. So to be upset about it being reallocated, I don't know. I think it could be interesting, because I'm a big proponent of presidents being able to make decisions. Like, that's one reason why, and there's a whole argument, there's a whole conversation to be had here, but China is essentially a dictatorship, and they get stuff done. Whether it's a good thing or a bad thing or a right thing or a wrong thing, things get done because their president just has power. So to me, I wouldn't be upset if our president could get more things done. Even if you agree or disagree with it, I feel like as long as things are getting done, that's what government's for. And then you can just vote someone new in if you want different things to get done. But I think that the argument that you should just have a stalemate because there's just a million different ways to, you know, roadblock and hinder progress. Well, I don't, if you agree or disagree with the progress, that's why you vote. I don't think that stalling action is the solution. So if Trump's going to get this done, it sounds like this is one of his main things he wants to do, get it done and then see what happens. And if you really don't like it, then don't vote for him the next election and get someone else who's going to spend the money differently. But to simply want a stalemate, it kind of grinds my gears, because then you're guaranteed no action with a stalemate.
Well, so I get that, but also people who want the stalemate are probably the same people who don't think that the government can fix all problems and don't want the government doing a lot of stuff that may in the future harm us. You know what I mean?
It's possible. I mean, I get the concept. I understand it. But just in my head, I'm cool with the government. As long as they're not taking more of my stuff. Like, I just don't see how the government, I'm never going to be on welfare. I'm never going to, like, have an issue. Like, I honestly, you know, it may be cocky of me, but I'm not even reliant on, like, government health care or government, or I don't, like, need the police to be watching my back 24/7, because I feel like I can hold my own. I mean, that's a little rash, but you know what I mean? Like, I don't see myself as relying on the government, so I'm cool with them screwing it all up. But I just hate seeing nothing happen. I don't know. But in other news, speaking of politics and presidencies, if you want to change from the old Donald, you can vote for Andrew Yang. I was listening to one of his videos. You guys probably don't even know who he is. Andrew Yang is running for president. He's,
do you know what party he's running for or running in?
He's running as a Democrat because you have to, which is another thing that's a necessity of politics. You have to play the game, and that's the first step of playing the game, is you have to pick a party that actually has a chance to win, and there's two parties that do. And so he's running as a Democrat. He currently holds about 1% projections of votes, which is what you need in order to be validated as, like, a legitimate candidate and make the ballot. So he's made the ballot. He is, let me give you a little background. Let me see, I can remember it. He got a degree in economics from Columbia. No, that's not right. He got a degree from another college in New York, and then he got his law degree from Columbia. Anyways, the guy's a genius. And what he did was, he was a lawyer for about 6 months, totally hated it, quit that. Then he became like a serial entrepreneur, and one of his biggest ventures was starting a company that basically crowdfunded money for entrepreneurs to start businesses. So instead of all of the smart people flocking to California and New York, because that's where the opportunity was, he was essentially creating opportunities in other cities to kind of disperse, you know, the wealth of knowledge. And regardless, he's a good guy. And one of his points as a Democrat is universal basic income. And what that is, where for him specifically, it would be that every person in the country gets $1,000 a month, which is cool.
Is that the number he said, or is that like the example you're saying?
Right. So his point was everyone would get $1,000 a month. He calls it the freedom dividend. And from there, it's just enough to take the edge off. It's enough to where if you get fired from your job, you can survive for a month or two until you get a new one. If you want to take a risk at being an entrepreneur or something like that, you're not going to starve to death. And that's the point also, is it's also not enough to live off of, so you can't just live off of it. You're going to have to work. And amongst other things, his biggest point of it, which we'll talk about in a minute, but his point is, with the increase of technology, jobs are simply being eliminated. And even though jobs are eliminated, the same production value is being created. It's just by robots. So at this point, you know, let's extrapolate this to the extreme that one day we live in a utopia where 100% of all work is done by robots and people don't need to do anything besides sit around and twiddle their thumbs and play basketball, you know, or whatever it is that you enjoy doing. So at that point, what's supposed to happen? Is it supposed to be the five people that own all the robots just be quadrillionaires, and then everyone else is homeless, and at some point there's got to be some redistribution of wealth if we pull it to that extreme where there's literally zero jobs left on this planet. Now, that's way far from reality, and arguably there's a whole, you know, array of different paths you can take along the journey to get there, but that's his point for universal basic income.
Well, so
what do you have? What are your thoughts?
So the idea of universal basic income, me personally, I think it's either that or welfare, which the welfare system, there's a lot of different programs and all that. I like the idea of just one fund, but the 1,000 a month, the thing about that is you could either use it for like a security blanket, so if shit hits the fan, you get fired, something medical comes up, you save the 12,000 every year just for security. Or you could use the 12,000. My personal opinion, I would probably, if I was getting 12,000 extra a year on a universal basic income, I would use that money for just future investments. Save it up, buy some property. So me personally, I don't mind the idea. I think it's a decent idea. But a problem could be people just spending it and blowing it on nothing, and then you end up with the same problem you had before.
Right, so that's one of my issues with it, is there's a lot of forms of welfare today, whether it's food stamps or, you know, housing assistance, where they're providing the service, not just cash for the service. And what I feel like will happen if, I mean, there's a whole range of reasons why people are on welfare, but a major part is that a lot of people just don't know how to spend their money, don't know how to plan, don't know how to do this or that. And it could be for nefarious reasons, or it could be for non-nefarious reasons. But regardless, my fear is that we start a UBI and we say, here's your money, this is your welfare, but they're responsible for using that money for all the different facets of welfare that they usually just provided in service form. And then they're going to end up either blowing it or just spending it unintelligently and then still be in need of those services. So let's say that they get their $1,000 and they spend it on something. It could even be important. Let's say their car broke down. They spend it on their car because they're like, we have this money. And then what? And then now they don't have money for rent or for food. So then there's people are going to be like, well, I still need the food stamps. And I guess it's not even a fear, but just I think that a legitimate potential is that we start a UBI, but just don't decrease other forms of welfare. And then at that point, is it a better option or is it just more money being redistributed, which some people are cool with? You know, if you're an AOC follower, you want a 70% individual tax rate, which is, that's another issue that we need to talk about, is we're very, we do have some hard set opinions, but me and Nick are very open-minded, and we need to, I guess, bring in other people's points of views. And I guess if you want a 70% tax rate, then you could be cool with having UBI and welfare.
Yeah, I think that'd be, I personally believe that'd be a waste of money, but I always like to play devil's advocate. So I always try to listen to other right. people's ideas and try to put myself in their shoes. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it does change my mind. Other times I just brush it off. But more on the UBI and like the reasoning for it is like technology advancing and all that. There was a study that came out recently that more than half of employees worldwide, 56%, said that they don't have the adequate digital skills for future jobs. And a majority of U.S. employees feel that companies, 26% of the people in the U.S., think that companies are responsible for teaching them and developing their digital skills. And in second place was 24% think that it falls on the government to teach them the new technological skills. Me personally, I think that's pretty crazy. 50% of people think it's someone else's job to teach them how to better themselves, to better their lives, to make it.
Right. I'm going to take it a step back. Let me just say what I got to say. So going back to Andrew Yang, one of the things is that, as I said, technology is increasing to the point where jobs are just being eliminated. And this argument that says for every job that your argument here, just even before we even talk about whose responsibility it is to teach them, is for every job that's destroyed is a job created. So this argument that anyone who loses a job can just be retrained and given a higher skilled job, it's not going to happen. And that's one of the things is that one of the specific instances that candidate Yang was speaking about was truck drivers. It's our biggest industry person-wise. It's about 3 million people are truck drivers. So I don't care if we send them all to Ivy Leagues. Is there enough job opportunities to just transition 3 million people out of a declining industry and into a new one? It doesn't exist. It's you can't do it. That's the issue here, is even when we want to retrain people, is it possible? And also, do they even want to? It's something like 30% of people that graduate high school go to college. So those other 70% of people, maybe they don't want to be educated on, you know, graphic design and working in a studio somewhere. And tying this back into immigration real quick, there's a quick touchback, is people want to have immigration at an continuously increasing level, comparable, and a big validation for that is just historic immigration, and people are calling other people racist for wanting to hinder the current immigration, which is mostly, you know, ethnic people versus the past when it was European. But the question there is, with this increased technological advancement and a decrease in jobs, especially lower level jobs, even if we increase our immigration, those are most people that immigrate here are trying to get a unskilled job. So now we're eliminating unskilled jobs by the masses, and the people we're bringing in want unskilled jobs, and the people that have our unskilled jobs are losing their unskilled jobs. Are we supposed to send every person in this country to some sort of tech school? You can't. It's not going to be possible.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's the idea of you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So I agree with you on that point. But then again, for the younger people who are mid-20s, early 20s, who are getting into these jobs that slowly technology is advancing and starting to make these jobs obsolete, I personally think the responsibility should fall on them for not advancing their skills. Like, if your job is threatened by advancement of technology, you should be trying to learn new skills if you want to keep your job or find a new job. Like, to say that the company should pay for it, like, these companies and like CEOs are just trying to make as much money as possible, just like you are. Just if you started your own business, you wouldn't say, oh, I only want to make 60 grand a year off my business and call it and just settle at that. No, you're trying to make as much money as possible. You want to live the best life you can, they want to live the best life they can. So like, if that means firing people who don't evolve with the times and hiring people who know the skills, that's good for them. It's not their fault. I would put blame on the people who are taking these jobs that are becoming obsolete. It's their fault for not taking the action when the writing's been on the wall for like years.
Right. And then to make matters worse, the discussed solution is government. Like, well, government will solve this for me. Government will solve this issue. Government's not efficient. How is government going to solve the issue? the only thing government can do is tax and redistribute for the most part. There's not a whole lot they can do to help people. And I guess that's one of our main principles can be brought into play here on Freedom and Power. And it's, at the end of the day, are you going to bank your future on the potential that government finds a solution? Or are you going to find your own solution? I'm not even talking about what's right. Should government be responsible? Should companies be responsible for you? Should is this or that morally right? Throw that all out the window. Why would you leave it up to chance to assume that some people that don't even know you are going to come up with the right decision to make your life better? Why would you not just take it into your own hands now? And then you can be guaranteed the solution of you being taken care of because you know that you're going to put in the work necessary to get there. Why would you even leave it up to chance for some politician or some CEO to, you know, make the right loving call to take care of you?
Yeah, and I think this transitions pretty nicely into our free think segment is.
Yeah, so our free thinking segment is basically hitting back some old principles of freedom and power of you got to have a mission, you got to have a path. And that's kind of, you know, all the things we've talked about. We want to increase our level of information to where we're learning new things. And that's why we talk about things like this. That's why we talk about politics and we talk about business and we talk about all this stuff, because in order to identify new opportunities, you have to have, you know, a wide array of information. And you also need to just be aware of the way the world's heading and, you know, what is going on around you. But at the same time, you can't become so consumed with everything else that you don't focus on yourself. So it's kind of got to be a balance. You have to balance, you know, where you spend your time. And a majority of your time needs to be focused on yourself. And I think I'll just quickly say that I think a lot of the issues with people spending so much time just learning abstract knowledge and following the world, and yeah, they could be the most intelligent person in the world, but just knowing everything about everyone, but how much do they focus on themselves? And I think a big issue is when people become very successful, whether you're listening to a podcast or you're following some sort of influential politician or business leader, they've already been massively successful on their own. So then they're able to spend more time learning like the more abstract ideas and thinking about other people. But you can't think about other people until you've thought about yourself. And that's what people need to realize. And they need to make sure that they balance, you know, thinking about the rest of the world with how much you focus on yourself. So the first step is, you know, you need to have a mission. You need to know what you want. What are the three steps to success, Nick? Do you know them?
Yeah, you gotta know what you want. You gotta be willing to take risk when it's needed, and you can't let people saying that you can't do it. You can't let the haters keep you down.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's what it takes, and that's what you have to do. And if you read any of like the autobiographies of anyone that's been massively successful, whether it's Thomas Edison to Andrew Carnegie, I like to think about the people of old, because back then it was I think more noticeable when people were creating massive wealth and success. But what anyone will say is they found success one step after failure, meaning that they failed unimaginably. They completely were on the verge of quitting. And that's that point where most people will quit. Most people will say, I made a good run. I did my best. I legitimately tried. And now I just happened to fail. So now I'm going to cut my losses and move on with my life and get a regular job and just be the guy who didn't quite make it. And most people would think that, okay, well, I tried. And they think that that just is the way life is supposed to work. But the truth is that you need to push it to that next level, and you need to take that next step after failure. And that's where most people are finding their success. That's what these people did. If you think, I think that when we talk about the necessity for failure, people think that you're supposed to have little failures and then learn from them, and then, you know, you're going to eventually be successful. No, no, you're supposed to have massive failures. If you lose everything, if you have nothing left, and you're ready to legitimately just give up, that's when you push. That's when you take your next step. That's the failures that you have to work through. That's how you get there. And that's just something that you have to focus on. You know, when you have
something that I guess grinds my gears is when people don't have a chance to quit or a chance to fail. They're too worried about failing, where they don't go for the success. They don't want to take any risks. They don't want to pursue it because they just, I don't know if it's a pride thing. They don't want to fail. Well, I bet part of it is pride. But the other part is they're too scared if they fail that they won't be able to come back, which is an understandable thing, but it's just something you're going to have to overcome if you want to be successful in your own mission, your own personal goals.
100%. That's what it takes. I mean, when you focus in on your mission and you make it the only thing that matters. Like, I don't know how else to describe this besides say that, but you guys need to let it sink in. It's got to be the only thing that matters to you. It means you burn bridges. It means that you lose friends. Your family might turn on. Everything. The need to succeed at your mission is the only thing that matters. I think what a lot of people think is that they're living their life. They have their goal. They've done a good job. They've created a goal. They've taken risk, you know, and they pursue it, with a decent amount of effort. But then, if they fail, what they'll do is they'll change their goal, and then try again. You never change your goal. The goal should stay the same. You should change your life to meet the goal, not the other way around. You don't change your goal based on your life. You change your life based on the goal. And it should be everything. You should be taking the biggest risks. Your life could be flipped upside down, but you just never forget that goal, because that is what should be that burning desire inside of you. That's the way you have to look at it. And I feel like I'm sounding crazy here, or I'm over explaining a basic topic, but that's just the reality of it. You need to legitimately realize that that's how hard you have to go. You need to be potentially willing to be homeless, potentially willing to, you know, lose everything, lose your family, get a divorce, have your parents turn on you, have your girlfriend move out with your dog, and then you don't get to see your dog anymore. It's sad, but whatever it is in your life.
Well, so to make you not sound crazy, he's using mostly hyperboles. Obviously, you don't want those things. If you can keep them and be successful, that's great. But what he's trying to say is that it's going to take some risks, it's going to take some sacrifices to get your goals done. And that's where it's going to come to you to decide what you're willing to sacrifice to get there.
What are you going to sacrifice to get there? And just, is it your number one thing? Is it your number one thing? If it's not, it has to be the top. If you have anything ahead of your goal, then technically the other thing's your goal, and your goal is just a secondary, you know, desire behind. Like, it needs to be, what is your life's mission? And it's this idea of purpose. The issue is a lot of people don't even know what their mission is.
Well, you see, like people think that, oh, work isn't everything, which I agree. All right, what you do for your job isn't everything, but you spend 8 hours a day at your job, 8 hours sleeping, and then 8 hours with your family or your own individual time. So roughly a third of your life is working. Why not do it in something that you enjoy and possibly can make lots of money at? Why not have it be something like a big goal, so when you're not at work, when you're not working, you can use that 8 hours of the extra time you have in your day to do something exciting, to live your best life.
100%. It's called getting to the goal line. I think a lot of people don't even realize that they never even, there's so many people that live their whole lives and they never even started. They save up for years to blow money on some sort of activity that other people do every day. So what are you doing? You know, you're waiting your entire year to get that 2 weeks vacation time where you get to do what you love. So you're doing what you love 2 weeks a year. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like if that's what blows my mind when people say, well, you know, I kind of like, I like working. I'm okay with it. Like, you shouldn't be okay with what you spend, you know, potentially the majority of your time with. You should be, well, one of the scariest things to me was people were breaking it down and they were saying, there's a potential that if you, like, let's say you work in an office in a major city and you live an hour outside of that office. So you're driving an hour there, driving an hour back, you're at work for 8 hours, that's 10 hours a day. So you're spending more time with the people that you work with than you do with your own family. Does that make any sense? Does that make any sense? And then let's say you don't even like the people you work with. So you're going to spend the vast majority of your life with people you hate so that you could spend 3 hours a night with people you love.
Oh, it's not even that. It's not even like the people. It's like what you're doing. A majority of people don't like their jobs. They just do it for the money. And it's not even a large sum of money. They do it just to live. You know what I mean? Just to scrape on by, live paycheck to paycheck. Why not pursue something greater than that? No. What do you have to lose? A job that you don't like? You know what I mean? Is this something you spend 10 hours a day of your life just you don't enjoy?
People get pulled into patterns. People get pulled into routines. And then they feel like, you know, there's nothing they can do. And there's just a multitude of different ways we could talk about this, different facets to the conversation. And that's what we aim to do here every day on this podcast, is try to go over the different aspects of this, you know, overarching idea. But if you don't understand the basic idea, you can never understand the rest of it. So there is I was reading this book, and one of the things that they said was, give me a second. I don't want to get in your way. Let me see if I can find it. Okay, it says, wealth, basically success, it was created from, in the form of definite knowledge that an intangible impulse of thought can be transmuted into material rewards by the application of known principles. So every day on this,
I'll explain it in plain English.
I will. So every day on this podcast, we're going to talk about principles. We've had, that's what our episodes are. We'll go over principles about, you know, what are different ways you can become successful. Here's the different ways to look at it, all of this stuff. But if you don't have the overarching goal, the overarching idea, then you can have every technique in the world to be successful, but if you don't have the idea and you aren't undyingly committed to that single idea, you're never going to get there. If you continue to change your idea every couple months when you hit a wall or you experience some sort of failure, it doesn't matter how many techniques you have. The techniques are secondary to you knowing what you want and you being committed to it and you being willing to accept sacrifices and risks and failures to get there. That's the key to this whole thing. And if you can't, and one of the ways you can do it is you can write it down. Well, this I've heard this multiple times, and you write down what you want as if you've already achieved it. So if you want $100 million, write down, I have $100 million. And read it every day to yourself. Convince yourself that you already have it. Convince yourself that you already have the job that you want. You already or have the lifestyle that you want. And your brain will subconsciously propel you in that direction. I mean, that's one aspect of it, but that's what you have to do. You need to convince yourself that it's not just a goal of yours. It's not just something that you hope to achieve one day. You need to convince yourself that that is who you are and what you will have. And every day you live without having achieved that goal is a day wasted. It should make you angry to be alive and not have achieved that goal. That's the way you have to look at it. There can't be an escape. There can't be well, this is my life. This is what I want. And if I don't achieve it, well, this is my life. It should be, that is my life. And right now I'm living in some morphed, you know, just wrong version of myself. And every day I don't achieve my goal is a day that I'm not living the life that I'm meant to be living. That's the way you have to look at it. Or is that crazy?
No, I agree with that. It's putting yourself in a position where you're changing your mindset. It's no longer something you want. It's more something you need.
And it kind of goes against modern day philosophies, because a lot of people will say, find a way to be happy with the life you have now. Don't live your life in pursuit of money or in pursuit of other things. They always say, you know, be happy with who you are now. And that's the opposite of it. Like, you shouldn't be depressed every day. But at the same time, if you're not where you're at, if you're not where you want to be, it's okay to be dissatisfied. It's okay to want more. And Nick said it perfectly. It is all about the mindset. There's not, people don't just achieve success. They become successful people, and then success just comes to them because they're living a lifestyle and pursuing ideologies and, you know, learning and growing as a successful person. And then that's when success falls. Unsuccessful people can't force success. You know, negative, you know, people who don't believe and don't live a lifestyle of success aren't gonna generate the level of success that they want. You have to change your life. This has to be an awakening for you. And I don't think I want to beat it to death, because we'll definitely have more conversations about it in the future. But that's just my point right now, is if you are listening to this podcast because you want to find techniques to be successful, that's great. That's good and all. You can read as many books as you want, but you better have that goal. You better have that goal, or else there was no point in any of this. There's no point in reading any book about success. There's no point in reading anything, learning anything, studying anything, if you don't know what you want and you're not willing to sacrifice everything to achieve it. That's all I got, though. Anything, Nick?
Yeah, I would just say, if you are one of those people who might have the mindset already or don't have the mindset, and you're working towards your goals, just don't quit when success could just be right around the corner.
It could be right around the corner.
But that's all we have for you guys today. So we're coming back from a 2-month break from the podcast. And new things is we're going to be releasing episodes every Wednesday now, not Tuesdays and Fridays, just due to the new schedules Miss and I have come up with. Just once a week, every Wednesday, and we'll potentially grow it to multiple episodes a week, but right now we're just backtracking to one episode a week. Remember, share the show with a friend. Share it. We're on Facebook, iTunes, wherever. And we'll talk to you guys next time.